Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Pacific Current Group Fiscal Year 2019 Results Call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would now like to turn the conference over to Tony Robinson. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you, everyone, for dialing in. We've got Paul Greenwood and Ashley Killick online, and they'll take over in a minute. I'm really just wanting to make a short introduction to say thank you and welcome to Paul and Ashley and to all of you, and also just to say we feel that 2019 was another step forward, significant step forward for us as a business, and are confident that it's laid good foundations for 2020 as well. And you know, on that and with that short introduction, I'll hand over to Paul to talk about the details of the year and what we hope that'll translate into the 2020. Paul, over to you.
Thanks, Tony, and thank you to those interested in this Pacific Current update. In the discussion today, I will try to give you a sense of the progress we believe we made in FY19 and offer some insights into what we expect in FY20, maybe with a brief recap that going into this year, really our strategic goals were to reshape our portfolio to make it less vulnerable to market shocks and more aligned with long-term trends in asset allocation, continue to work with our portfolio companies to help accelerate their growth, improve investor understanding of PAC and its business strategy, and then enhance our internal investment processes. And I think we've made I think progress in all those dimensions, but it certainly haven't completely finished those initiatives. If you turn to page four, look at it, starting at page five in the presentation, you will notice from the release that PAC is reporting significant growth in underlying profits. The presentation also details the consistent and rapid growth of aggregate FUM. It was a busy year on the portfolio management front as well, which I'll briefly review. And then lastly, I'll touch on the opportunities in front of us and what shareholders should expect on the new investment front. Page six provides a financial summary for the year, and you will see a variety of highlighted or high-level financial metrics. And as you look at this table, I'd like to highlight the following. FUM grew 51% for the year if we adjust for those boutiques that were sold. Underlying net profit before tax grew 50% to $27.4 million. Underlying net profit after tax grew 13% from $18.3 million to $20.6 million. The gap between underlying net profit before tax and underlying net profit after tax was relatively large. It was about 25%. We are always exploring ways to become more tax efficient. And going forward, at least maybe over the shorter term, next year or so, we would expect the effective rate to be lower, probably something closer to mid-teens than it was last year. But that figure, that sort of that tax leakage, will gradually rise as we continue to make more add new investments. PAC announced that it will be paying an interim dividend of 15 cents, bringing the dividend for the year to 25 cents per share compared to 22 cents in the prior year. And we finished the year with $64 million of dry powder to pursue new investments. And then our net assets per share grew 14% on the year to $8.05 a share versus $7.05 a year earlier. On page seven of the presentation, we highlight the portfolio growth. We had a strong fund growth during the year, with seven of the 11 companies with funds under management growing during the year. Obviously, GQG kept chugging along and growing at a very rapid pace, though Carlyle got to a very fast start as well. Victory Park did not grow as fast like we expected. for a couple of reasons that I'll elaborate on. The first was that they decided not to raise a couple of the non-core funds that were on the drawing board at the time we invested in them, and instead focused on a couple of new product areas. Those new initiatives required some additional investments for Victory Park, and while they didn't yield tangible results in FY19, they are now gaining traction and securing new FUM. Another reason they didn't grow as fast as we had hoped was due to a delay on a fund it hoped to launch earlier in the year with an Asian organization. That fund is now in market to be raised, so we are optimistic that we will see progress on this fund over the next few months. The slower-than-expected growth of VPC resulted in lower-than-expected earnings contribution from them in FY19. However, the majority of the shortfall versus our expectations related to issues of earnings recognition as opposed to sort of underperformance of the business. Specifically, Victory Park has $3.3 million of carried interest it has accrued on our behalf that the accounting standards don't allow us to recognize as earnings yet. In addition, the firm has another type of revenues that crystallize every calendar year end. These are referred to as incentive fees, and just like carried interest, we are not allowed to accrue these revenues before they are crystallized. Other developments during FY19 were the continued transformation of ROC into a PE firm increasingly focused on direct investments. That's one of the reasons why we increased our position in the firm during, actually shortly after the fiscal year end. Other highlights included the fast start of Carlyle and then the closing of Aether Fund 5 that happened in July a couple months ago. On the negative side were some outflows from Sizert and the loss of a significant piece of Alpha Shares business, which, while not particularly large, the Alpha Shares piece would probably cost us, several $100,000 in annual revenue going forward. On page 8, we just detail some of the portfolio changes to the portfolio during the year, and I won't go into detail on all of them, but you can see it was a relatively busy year with essentially four new investments, if we include the increase in our position in ROC that happened shortly after the fiscal year ended. And we sold three investments, all of which had been very successful investments for us. On page 9, we review give an overview of what we're seeing in terms of new investments. And as excited to say that the opportunity set of interesting investments continues to look really, really attractive. We are in the late stage of discussions with at least a couple of investments, and as a result, we are confident that capital will be deployed in the near term. No guarantees, of course, on that, but certainly we're quite confident. And while the size of our investments can vary, if someone were to say what sort of size range are we targeting, we would we'd say something in the $30 to $40 million Aussie range, and give or take a little bit. And as I have stressed before, we are looking for certain attributes in our investments that are both consistent with increasing our earnings consistency, yet providing healthy organic growth. And I'm going to elaborate a little bit more on this in a while here. If you go to page 11 of the presentation, we break out our Tier 1 and Tier 2 boutiques by FUM and level of contribution. It's worth noting that 85% of our revenues came from our Tier 1 boutiques, even though our Tier 2 boutiques actually significantly increased their contribution during the year. I should note that the largest change in the Tier 2 contributions came from a small investment we made in a firm called SCI, where we received a very nice performance fee during the last 6 months. From an investment perspective, if you turn to page 12, if you look at page 12, From an investment perspective, I'd say the year was, you know, fair to good. It wasn't the private capital strategies we invested in or private capital strategies we have an investment in performed, I'd say, quite well. And the long-only managers were generally mixed. GQG had a great performance year, and obviously that's helped to fuel its growth. Sizert had mixed results during the year from a relative performance sense. EAM and Black Crane had a little more challenging years, but there, for them it was a question of the last 6 months of calendar year 2018 being very, very difficult, and both of them having decent rebounds year to date. So if we move on to page 13, you have a slide that summarizes the FUM change by manager, with the obvious, you know, most noteworthy change there being the continued growth in GQG. The next page shows the steady growth in FUM of the portfolio, and while growth has been broad, obviously GQG has been the biggest contributor. One point we always try to emphasize is that aggregate FUM is not a particularly relevant metric for our firm, given the differences in ownership levels, fees, incentive fees, et cetera. So that's why we caution against extrapolating FUM into economics. And for some perspective on this, you know, I'd note that we receive roughly similar economic contributions from Aether as we do GQG, even though GQG manages probably 15 times more FUM than Aether. So it's just, and as we increase our exposure to private capital type strategies which tend to have higher fee structures, you continue to see this dynamic at play. On page 15, we reconcile the changes in FUM year over year. The one thing I note here is that we are seeking more closed-end type revenue. By that we mean revenues that are locked up for periods of time and not necessarily marked to market on a daily basis. And you can see that number is starting to climb. I think you'll see significant growth in the amount of closed-end type revenues. On page 16, we sort of, as an elaboration, it sort of supplements page 15, and you can see that the portfolio is moving toward less equity market exposure or contractual revenues. We now have minimal exposure to the Australian dollar, and it's not by design, but is an outgrowth of where we are finding interesting investments. On page 17, we're trying to highlight some of the diversification strides that we have made, and I think this is a really important chart, so I'm going to elaborate a little bit here. But some multi-boutique investment managers are essentially leveraged beta investments. In other words, the high operating leverage of the investments they invest in combined with their own operating leverage allow a multi-boutique to grow earnings far faster than the market itself when markets are going up. Of course, this works in reverse as well. And this is not what PAC is aspiring to be. Rather, we want to grow our business consistently and not have any particular risk like the stock market's performance control our economic fate. So toward this end, in FY19, about 33% of our revenues had no direct link to equity markets. This number should grow significantly in FY20 and be much higher than 50%. As a result of our diversification and the structure of our investments, we think we can reduce the impact of market declines on our financials significantly. And sort of to prove the point, I'd like to sort of walk through a conceptual example of that. For example, imagine that PAC only owned bottom-line stakes in long-only equity asset management firms. And then let's assume that all those businesses had a 40% margin, which is a fairly typical margin for a profitable long-only firm. Now imagine that PAC itself had a 50% margin, which is sort of in the general ballpark of what we have. If these assumptions were true, a 20% market decline would reduce each boutique's bottom line by 50%, thus reducing PAC's revenues by 50%. And because PAC had a 50% margin, the decline would wipe out 100% of our profitability, assuming no changes in expenses at boutique or at PAC's level. This is because boutiques have a lot of operating leverage, as does PAC, and when that works in reverse, as I mentioned, it can get fairly ugly quickly. So what we've tried to do is, as I mentioned, is minimize the impact of adverse markets on our financial results. So what we estimate that a 20% market decline would impact, instead of wiping out 100% of PAC's profitability, would reduce profitability by about 17%. That's obviously a rough estimate, but that's basically that occurs because of the structure of some of our investments and because some of our long-only managers have top-line participation instead of bottom-line. And we think that number, that 17% number, is actually likely to decline over time as we continue to diversify the portfolio. And, you know, we like the idea of having strong organic growth for reasons specific to each boutique rather than a business leverage to one risk that's outside of our control. I'm going to skip to really the summary page here, and then we can go to Q&A. So on the summary page, which is later in the presentation, I just want to highlight the following. We are very optimistic about continued growth at PAC. On the positive side, we expect to see increased contributions from Victory Park and ROC, and the annualization benefit from our investment in Carlyle. We are also confident that our earnings will be enhanced through the deployment of additional capital. On the negative side, we won't have any residual contribution from our stakes in Rare and Perio, and we would expect less contributions from Sizer due to the lower FUM they finished the year with. And also, as I mentioned earlier, we'd expect a less contribution from Alpha Shares. But combined with no expected material change or increase in expenses, we believe we are well positioned for future growth in FY20. So with that, I think we can move into the Q&A, and I'm happy to address any of the questions that one may have.
And for our phone audience, if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question over the phone line. And we do have a question in the queue. We'll go to our first caller.
Hi, guys. I'll probably just start with a question around Victory Park. Can you quantify the sort of items that were either timing or accrual related that should reverse into next year? I know that you put in $3.3 million of performance fees that were accrued but not booked, but presumably they remain at risk into December. But are there any other items that you can sort of count as will crystallize with a high certainty?
Sure. Yes. So there's the two pieces, and you mentioned one, Nick, which is the carried interest piece, which is the $3.3 million that we had mentioned. There is another piece, incentive fee piece of revenue that I mentioned that would be crystallized at the end of this calendar year. So for clarity purposes, carried interest is crystallized episodically depending on where a particular fund or separate account is in its lifespan. These incentive fees are crystallized annually on a calendar year basis. So, you know, the quantum of those incentive fees that we would expect to be crystallized at year end probably starts bumping up in the neighborhood of 15 million Aussie of revenue for Victory Park. And you can, that number is sort of, you could derive it by looking at the fees that are available, that are the announced fees on its listed vehicles, in one, the largest being one in London.
And sorry, that's an incentive fee just on the listed vehicles in the UK, which is that, just can you define an incentive fee? Is that effectively a performance fee by another name?
It is. Yes, it's exactly right, Nick. With a little different thresholds and things like that, but it is based on performance. So it is not a certainty. It is a reasonably high probability.
And can you just explain again why the fundraisers that were anticipated for the year slipped or were determined to be delayed? Just some context around that.
Sure. Really, it was a strategic decision on behalf of Victory Park to pursue some other initiatives that they felt had a better short and intermediate term prospects. Those initiatives related to providing products into the insurance markets and as well as ramping up their efforts on the legal finance front. And in exchange sort of for direct, or they, you know, the funds that they didn't pursue were not meant to be particularly large funds, but would have contributed nicely to, to the management fees. So we sort of lost a period of time. The good news is, as I've mentioned earlier, we are seeing progress on these new initiatives, and I think upcoming FUM reports will be able to quantify some of that progress.
And are there origination and establishment sort of fees with those funds that can lead to upfront an over revenue recognition in the upfront, and then, or is it more just the management fee once the funds raised?
No, I would say it's more a management fee when the fund is raised, plus carried interest over the life of the fund.
Okay, and then the incentive fee that you mentioned, that was effectively what we missed out on at that first half result because of the position in Elevate. But you're saying that for the half year or up until August, they've now accrued our performance, which means that product should see a fee.
I believe that's right. And I had a hard time hearing you, but yes, the what they've accrued through the first 6 months of the year, is more incentive fee than they recognized in all of last year.
But Nick, to answer the question, I heard it a bit better, and yes, you're right. The incentive fee was, we didn't get the incentive fee last year on the UK LIC, and the actual spread between the hurdle rate and the lending rate is pretty set, and the funds are pretty well deployed. You know, very occasionally there'll be a principal loss on a loan that eats into that incentive fee. But otherwise, the incentive fee is very stable out of that. And you're right, we missed it at the 31st of December for the fact that there was a loss, principal loss that offset the share of the difference between the hurdle rate and the lending rate of the fund.
Okay, that's great. Because if we add up the 3.3 of carried interest, and we add to that your share of the incentive fees, presuming that there's no sort of staff leakage, then that's another $4 million potentially. That's a $7 million uplift year on year from the position in VPC. Is that a that's just the back of the envelope? Is that a sort of a reasonable assumption?
I'm trying to just do the math on that. I think four might be a little high, but it's a significant number. Maybe.
Nick, I think so. That is about right, and that takes us back to the sort of numbers that we've expected to earn out of this than we talked about when we made the acquisition. So.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, back up towards that circa $9 or $10 million contribution at the NPAT line for tax. But so then the potential of the boutique contribution pre tax could be bigger than that. Can we just talk about the investment in Roc? Maybe it's worth sort of giving a bit of I know the announcement was relatively light on metrics, but what are they going to do with that money? How are things shaping up for them into next year?
Things are going very well at Roc. I would describe it as a business that has really accelerated nicely over the last year, and that acceleration is continuing. They, as I mentioned earlier, they've really transformed their business into a direct private equity business. So while their FUM has grown nicely, the composition of the FUM in terms of fee levels and everything else have grown much better than that. So I would say, they've gone from being a minimal contributor in FY18 to providing some contribution FY19 to much more significant contributor in FY20. They'll be in tier one and a half or something like that, somewhere between the typical tier two contribution and the tier one contribution.
The multiple
we invested in that is a multiple that is sort of standard, consistent with what we've, the multiple ranges that we generally discuss when we're looking at these investments.
Okay, and then one of the other boutiques that you touched on briefly was SDI, booked a very large performance fee. Can you give us some sense on the repeatability of that, or should we just think of that as sort of a significant one-off?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, we hope it's repeatable, but it is. SCI was a hedge fund seeding company, and it seeded one manager, but that manager has been a wildly successful investment, from the one they seeded. So we received a performance fee of around, I think, 1.8 million Australian for that year. It's replicable to the extent they continue to perform, but that the underlying manager is what's called a CTA, which are sort of traditionally very difficult to predict performance for. So I can't say other than we have sort of some expected value of future contributions, but little ability to predict timing.
Sure, because I guess that was the difference between PBT and NPAT this year was number one, tax, and number two was the non-controlling interest back to SCI. Can you touch on what, maybe it's a question for Ashley, but what constituted that higher tax rate on last year? I think it worked out to be around 20%, 25% including the NCI. But can you get a sense of what's in that 20% tax rate and I think you indicated mid-teens going forward, just some color around that.
Yeah, well, I'd say, you know, what's in that was is sort of normal stuff, and it's just that as we explore our ability to achieve tax efficiencies, we think there's efforts for there's opportunity to enhance that going forward, and so we've been exploring that, and we're fairly confident that we can. That we can bring down the tax leakage, and so I don't know that it's anything particularly anomalous in that period versus perhaps more a commentary on what we think we can accomplish through more thoughtful, tax planning.
And Nick, just to add, sorry, Nick, I was just going to say, part of it is just the point that Paul's, I think, touching on there is there's just a change in mix too. Carlisle, for instance, has a lower tax rate than, say a Rock. So as the mix of, earnings changes, the average tax rate, the aggregate tax rate comes down.
Yes, okay, that's good to know. You mentioned Carlisle there. Obviously, the fund with Carlisle is up 35% since the time you made your investment. Given it's a revenue share, is it safe to assume that the contribution that you're getting out of that business is 35% higher? And the effective multiple that you acquired that stake now looks very attractive.
I think that is fair, Nick. And one of the things we didn't mention in this, but they did successfully close their Absolute Return Fund 1 in July. And so we will get 16% of their revenues. The only caveat to that is that there is, as we've discussed before, there is a portion of the revenues we receive from them that are performance fees, and those performance fees are crystallized every quarter, which is nice, but that component of what we receive from them, because it's performance based, is a little less predictable, even though their performance has historically been exceptionally consistent. So, but yes, in general, one could certainly the management fees will grow at exactly 16% times FUM.
And Nick, for, again, clarity, when Paul talks about being crystallized, I think, Paul, I'm right in saying that the payments, the quarterly performance fees, are actually paid in cash paid quarterly, aren't they?
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. That's helpful to know. And then, so you mentioned that they closed their Absolute Return Fund. We've obviously seen very consistent flows from them over the last 6 months. Is that partly the capital that they're raising to that fund coming through, or that's a FUM uplift that we'll see into July, and their open-end vehicles are the ones that have accounted for that large growth?
I think through June 30, I'm going to be roughly correct in this. I think those FUM numbers include 150 to 170 million, or that's of Absolute Return Fund 1 assets. And what I'm saying is that that fund ultimately closed in July at a higher level of about 230 US. And the rest of the growth has been in their open end fund, which is the long term growth fund.
Can you maybe just provide a bit of comment around, I think from what I can tell, most of the liabilities on the balance sheet will be crystallized in the next year. And that's including the Aether and Nereus, the size of notes, and then you'll end up with a pretty clean balance sheet and then with a sort of, I calculate sort of $45 million of cash to deploy once you net off all those liabilities. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think that's generally right. Those lingering liabilities should largely be taken care of in the short term. A lot of it before calendar year end.
Period. Still a purview.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So potentially may not crystallize.
Yeah.
Any of that third ARA bond.
That's right.
Crystallize in the next 12.
Okay, great. So, I mean, if I think about what we should look at into next year, the tax rate should come down, so that should be very helpful. Potentially that NCI is not there from SCI, but a net, it's a benefit anyway. But then we should expect quite a significant uplift from Carlisle, given the progress that they've made, a normalisation of Victory Park, a bit extra from Rock, organic growth from Aether, and then a decline at Pfizer. Is that sort of an around-the-ground that's sort of accurate into 20?
I think that's fair, and I guess against the backdrop of, you know, no material increase in expenses, you know, hopefully they're lower, but certainly we don't have any plans to increase expenses significantly.
And Nick, I would add to that, and I know you've picked this up, but the other part for Carlisle is not just the step up in earnings, but it's the annualisation of it. We've only owned that for part of the year in 19. And the other is that we're still not fully invested, so our cash earns nothing, or near enough to nothing nowadays. And we've got a full acquisition pipeline. So if you thinking about 20, you should also be thinking about, well, what's the prospect of these guys deploying the last of that cash, say, at the midpoint of the year, and what price earnings multiple will it be deployed at? Well, we've talked about what sort of price earnings multiples we look to deploy that capital at. So the change is the step backs for the point that you've touched on, things like size out and so on. But the steps forward are really significant, and they include, you know, the step up in earnings from Carlisle, the annualisation of Carlisle, the return of the ability to bring to account the performance fees at Victory Park, and the ability to deploy the last of the cash, and the step up in the shareholding in Rock. So yeah, certainly it should be a good uplift between the 19 result and the 20, and then that's pre-tax. You've got also the benefit of the lower tax rate that we're expecting to see in 2020 versus 19.
All right, great. Thanks. I'll let someone else ask the question.
And as a reminder, that is star one on your touchtone telephone to ask a question. And there are no additional phone questions at this time.
Okay.
I'll wrap it up on that basis. Paul, do you want to add anything else? I think it's actually quite a nice place to wrap it up. We've just talked about what we're expecting to see as an uplift in the profit for 2020 versus 19, and I think that's a great statement of, you know, what's been achieved by Paul and his team in finding great investments and deploying them, and seeing that now translate through to the to the P&L and the cash flow of the business. So if there's no other questions, I'll wrap it up and let Paul get on with making some visits to fund managers over the next couple of days. Don't hesitate to contact Paul or myself or Ashley if you've got any other questions. Thank you all very much for participating. We'll close that out.
And that is today's conference call. We thank you all for joining us.